So welcome to the second episode of Tessient Talks. This is the series where we sort of try and do a bit of a deeper dive on specific aspects of things that we're interested in generally and that are going on in market. Today we're here to talk about retail processes, retail excellence, retail efficiency, how we want to describe that. So I'm obviously Matt Neal, I'm one of the managing partners at Tessient. I haven't worked in retail since I was 18, so my knowledge of retail process is going to be very, very rusty. So treat me like an 18-year-old Saturday person. I'm here with Stuart and Ross. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, morning. Stuart Smith, managing partner for Tessient. Background in retail. So Tesco's for 25 years. Bit of time in Australia with Coles Group as their retail director, and then Morrison's as group operations director, and then obviously managing partner now with Tessient.
Bringing your knowledge to the world. Ross?
Yeah, I'm Ross McFarland, so I've been at Tessient for 2 years now, but prior to that, yeah, always in retail, so unlike you, Matt, in terms of that short stint at 18, I started about 17 years old and was with Tesco for almost 21 years. And then, yeah, on to Morrison's. And then, yeah, here I am at Tessient. So, yeah.
And Tesco is obviously renowned for its processes. Retail renowned for phenomenally complex processes, really. I mean, I think about the processes and businesses that I've worked in sort of post-graduation, they've been very simple from a process perspective. So I'm diving straight into the complexity. What makes retail such a complex place to work?
I think it's people all the way through the business. So trying to get all different people lined up on the same mission all the way through, whether that be the product, the sourcing, the quality, the transport, the logistics, the movement and handling, and then the placement, making it right for customers and having that customer lens and ensuring then that all of that contributes to a great product at the right time, at the right quality, at the right price. And each customer equally is looking for something slightly different as well. So it's it becomes quite a high bar. And therefore, lots of moving parts, lots of handoffs. That's where you see the complexity and all the value, depending on how you look at it.
I think in addition to the people part, if you just look at the huge volume of input that you've got to get through thousands of products and hundreds of suppliers into a chain through hundreds, maybe thousands of stores, and then out the other end to hundreds of thousands, millions of customers and all those transactions.
And everything's got to be there, right place, right time. So how many thousands of SKUs would a national supermarket have?
If you're looking at an average supermarket, probably we're 28,000 products. And then you've got all the different conditions as well, right? So you've got different temperature regimes, you've got products like sandwiches that are coded for 1, 2, 3 days through to general merchandise products with huge long lead times coming from long distances away, and then everything in between. So yeah, lots of products, lots of different conditions, lots of different things to think about that you've got to then put procedures in place, systems in place to try and simplify as much of that as possible.
You also got lots of channels as well, so it's not just stores. You clearly you've got multiple channels. I think in Morrison's, which would be not dissimilar to any sort of standard grocery retailer anywhere in the world, I think we had 14 different channels we were trying to fulfill at any one time, and that kept growing depending on what partnerships you'd got. So I think that adds another layer of complexity.
Yeah, and somewhere like Morrison's as well, they've got all the counter offer, all the different market street things to think about as well. So you're bringing,
you're making stuff on site.
Exactly,
there,
you're bringing an orderable product in, you're turning it into multiple saleable products, and then you're trying to manage accuracy through all that as well. So again, that's pretty complex that you've got to try and make as simple as possible and put the right procedures and the right systems in place, train people in the right way. There's all those variables that you've got to think about within the whole chain.
When it goes wrong, when there's a broken process in that kind of environment where you've got perishable goods, you've got, you know, that, those complex environments, that can have a massive impact on bottom line, right? So
yeah.
What's the worst thing you've seen? Obviously, don't name any company names, but have you got an example of something that was really broken and what effect that had?
Yeah, I remember pressing the wrong button in a store once when we were doing all the stock control in a store and ordering a lorry full of strawberries in the store. It obviously got stopped, but there was things like that where if the systems weren't tuned right, it could be some pretty scary outcomes.
So you have to build in checks and balances as well to make sure that...
Absolutely. So straight away someone at the depot is phoning you to say, well, are you sure you want all these? But yeah, and then I think when you're applying new systems and things are starting to land, you've got to be very careful, you know, moving out of one and, you know, way of working one system into another. I've certainly seen a few pretty scary waste bills on the end of things when they don't get implemented.
I think when you're putting new systems in, I've seen some impacts through that. If you think about a manufacturing process, it's very different to a customer-led process in a store environment or in a a dot-com channel or whatever. And I think you have a mismatch in terms of manufacturing is optimised for speed of productivity, etc. And will be producing whatever it needs of a product, regardless of what else is going on. And it's how you link that into, you know, the customer demand at the other end. Otherwise, you end up with too much or too little, which has implications. You see some significant problems, either usually system or process issues that mean that handoff doesn't work. I think about an instance of sausage rolls just going missing at Christmas time, for example, in one organisation that I looked at, and situations with handoffs on systems particularly where, you know, perhaps some of the diligence that needed to be in place or the broader knowledge of the impact of some of the decisions that were being taken needed to be better. And that can cause you to be in a position where at various points a system doesn't work for something that's probably fairly minor, but it hasn't flowed through properly. So it means that people can't serve customers or they can't move stock at the right time. So you see some fairly tense exchanges on that basis.
And the tension is in how tight the profit is for the volume that you're putting through and how tight the competition is, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, when things go wrong, the impact can be pretty big. You've got to try and be as accurate as you absolutely can be.
It's a very competitive market, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like you say, I remember working with a fashion retailer many years ago. They put a new system in, supply chain system, lost complete sight of all their stock visibility in the run-up to Christmas, which was disastrous for them, tanked their share price as a result. And we had to help them at the time with a team to try and rectify that. It sort of seems like, I guess IT is saying it's going to be really simple to put this thing in, and then the complexity comes in you know, the people interacting with it, doesn't it?
And visibility is key, I think, in any business still. And I still think, it's great working with Tessian because you get to work with lots of different businesses and you can help lots of different businesses. But I think I still see businesses striving for and struggling with visibility of their product and how that interacts with their relevant processes, as it, regardless of what product it is, frankly. It could be clothing, it could be non-food goods, etc. It can be perishable goods. All of them struggle with visibility, or systems that are not optimised to their full extent. Some people have got some good systems but are not using them to their full extent, so there's better value that you can create there. And some are coming from quite a low base, and it's how you can do that in generation jump, using other, AI and various other bits in an appropriate way to give you some visibility and advantage.
Why is visibility such a challenge then?
I think it's to Ross's point, it's coming from so many different sources, the product. It's either being amalgamated from a manufacturing process and then being handed off, or it's being almost made as it goes. And then it's how it moves from so many places and through so many different channels. Even to the point that even if you can get it all the way through from the manufacturing process to a point that you've got it in a warehouse, and you might need multiple warehouses, but a warehouse, and then which channel do you send it to first? Because you might have 6 or 7 pools on the same product pool. Mm. And if you haven't got the right visibility and forecast model to get to that stage, then how do you decide which channel of customer interaction and demand is going to get first pull on that stock? And then in some cases, it will just naturally go to one place and people don't realise it's gone and already been allocated in their sort of system to place A, and actually there's customers in place B and C and D waiting for it, whether that be a physical customer store or whether that be through a digital marketplace or whatever. So I think that adds complexity, and people haven't got full visibility, and they're putting systems in to try and do that. But even so, again, knowing that the systems are only as good as the rule set that you put around them, the process you put around them, I think I see people missing that quite a lot, because they look at it from a perspective of, I've got a new IT system. The IT system has been sold to me. It does X, Y, and Z, and it will do. But actually, it's how you frame that in your organization's infrastructure that makes the difference.
I think there's a bit, it's that cliche, right? Rubbish in, rubbish out, in terms of what that starting point is. How accurate are you at the start? How simple is it around one code per item, all that type of thing, it is one big factor. Because when the starting point's wrong, then you're just adding more variables on that as you go through, and it just gets worse and worse. Kind of chaos theory, it just keeps going. And the second is, you've just got so many human touch points, interactions, especially in live stores, rather than dark stores or kind of .com fulfillment centers, or warehouses, but in the real live stores, you just think how many millions of human beings are touching the product to get it on the shelf, and then taking it off the shelf and scanning it through the tills, or indeed walking it out of the shop in terms of theft or loss, so there's just all those variables that make accuracy then very, very difficult to manage in some instances.
And so what are the ways around that? Technology's obviously improved over the sort of 20, 30 years you've been doing this, right? We've got things like RFID and less places where people are going to be keying things into something, presumably now.
I think it depends on the maturity of the business. Yeah. I've seen businesses at one end of the scale that have got good systems and then they're building on top. And then you've got businesses that are coming from a lot more simplistic base, but have probably exploded their customer base and their route to market, and therefore have realised they then need to invest more. So I think you've got both. I think a common denominator in both is that people will have worked usually in organisations for a long time, and they've got very good at finding workarounds or wayarounds they do. And so I think you need some good leadership from that organisation, or some external viewpoint, if you like, to sort of cut through the art of the possible. What I see when people are buying new systems when they're coming from a low basis is that they buy a system that's pretty capable, but they don't get the full use of it because they're still putting in that sort of human intervention, because they've got a team of people that, we do this really well, we think, and therefore we should be able to continue that process. So they bend the system to that. The application of AI is a good example. One of the organisations I work with had got lots of really knowledgeable people that were trying really hard to make stock management decisions. And they would do that off of their own sort of, very good knowledge base, and had done that for years. But as it got more complex, they would be 50% right some of the time, 50% wrong some of the time. The reality is, when you've got an AI forecast and you're using it in the right way, you might be doing 25 million calculations per day. There's no human being that can work all those variables, and consequently it's about how you blend the human element into it in the right way. Whereas people tend to make small steps and dilute on that basis.
Yeah.
And I think the same happens again when you've got a better base. That next stage and where you go to and what the art of the possible is and how you create value is again, it needs some clear guidance and thought.
And how do you take people on that journey then from a company who has people putting things through spreadsheets and their own workarounds and an off-the-shelf process, which in many ways could be better, but they start to try and change that system to bend to the process rather than changing the process to bend to the system?
I think you get both. I mean, you get some really sophisticated systems that have been built up over many years, and have been very successful. And therefore, there's risk in changing too much as well, because they might lose some of that advantage versus I'm coming from a spreadsheet, but I feel like I've got control and then I'm giving control. You need the engagement of the team, taking them on the journey, trying things really quickly in small bite-sized chunks that fast thing in a controlled manner, and then scaling fast once you've worked out what the process should be and that people are comfortable with it. I think giving very clear parameters and principles and then reviewing it against that. The amount of businesses you go into and say, well, how much variability do you want? And they haven't really said, so I think in the past year I've gone in and said, we're only going to have 10% intervention. And that's our aim, because we think we can get the best out of the changes, the system, etc., on the basis of that. And therefore then reviewing the hell out of that to get to the right answer. Whereas lots of businesses just go in, they've not really set the parameters in the first instance. So it's very hard then to judge your progress against that. And you'll get progress, but you might not get the full value that you could be getting out of that system. And I think that's true at either end of the scale, if I'm honest. So I think there's really, really good set of balance measures that you hold the, not just the IT team, not just the supply chain team, not the commercial team. It's a very multi-teamed approach. Everybody's got a piece of the pie.
Yeah, and I think being very clear about what all those metrics are is really important. I see quite a bit of, different people with different opinions, with different metrics and different intentions, and all of a sudden you're cobbling together something that, isn't really one version of what you're trying to create, So I think that's really important as well, that comes together, that everybody's very clear on what those metrics and conditions need to be. And I think that helps a lot, because I think that ambiguity is where it can sometimes fall down. And then to your question, Matt, how are you bringing people with you on that? If you're all very clear on what that looks like, then it makes an enormous difference, I think.
I think you have to take a holistic business view as well. So I think a lot of times you'll see the change originate in an IT team. Sometimes you'll see it coming from the business team, but I think the blend of the two. And I also think you need, it could be internal, it can be external. You need an overarching mission, if you like, to bring all that together. It can't just be an IT change. It can't just be either a business change, and it needs to be the two harnessing each other's skills. And some organisations are set up to do that, and they've got an internal sort of change or transformation team that could help. But even then, it depends what their outside business view is. I feel very lucky to have a grounding in Tesco that really helped train me and be exposed to lots of different circumstances. But then equally, as you then work with other companies, and particularly under the consultancy role, seeing lots of things, you can see the commonality and challenges where people don't look at things in that holistic way. They haven't got outside reference, or they're looking at a parent company in some examples where they're taking their lead very much from that parent and the IT and all the processes, and then suddenly they've perhaps gone out on their own or whatever, and they see they've got to all replace systems, etc. I've seen that where they haven't got necessarily a frame of reference, what's on the market, how do you then blend that? And that's all fine, but if you don't blend that into the right business-led change with business outcomes, then I think you can lose your advantage.
Yeah, and just building on that around Tesco, because, I grew up in Tesco, and didn't know anything different until I left, right? And actually understanding from the shop floor through all the different roles that I had, you could see that commonality and the consistency and the process and the application of it, and everybody really knowing where their role started and finished. And then actually being able to go and work with other people now, and you revert back to that actually, and the processes and what you were trying to achieve, even like in those very early days when I was just starting in Tesco, you know, things that store managers trained me on still ring true now. Mm. We've just got an awful lot more technology around us to try and support with some of the bits that were quite manual and had to be done in a different way. So I think the applying all those types of principles is great, and then it's finding the right point in which to utilise the technology, and I find that really exciting because that's where you can bring that thinking together.
And is it the years of experience from shop floor onwards that allows you to look at a process end to end and go, well, if I make a change here, that's going to have an effect here, but it could also have an unintended consequence somewhere else? Or do you have to have the sort of brain that works that way?
I think it's drummed into you that it's always about customers. So you're always coming from the customer end, regardless of the organisation. Everybody's got a customer. So I think if you can have a customer lens and what is making it easier and better for the consumer, but really then importantly applying that to the colleagues and the team. So how have you simplified that colleague's piece of work so that they can deliver the absolute best product or service to the customer? And I think if you then take that all the way back to the sourcing, the manufacturing, everything, then you have a chance of simplifying and utilising, you know, technology or the process in a way that will give you the best result. I think people get very excited about the technology and or all the things they need to do, and they can overcomplicate and lose sight of how easy have you made it for the colleague to deliver that sort of groundbreaking service or product to the consumer in a consistent way, you know, in a way that people can rely on. Particularly with all the challenges you've got now, whether that be the economic climate, whether it be the geopolitical climate, or whether it be, you know, COVID, et cetera, all of that has come under pressure. The businesses that I see prospering, surviving, growing, I think have embraced aspects of that, or if not all of that.
Yeah.
It's keeping that consumer at the heart of it.
What was that, what Tesco got so right about it then, do you think?
I think so. I mean, I still, you know, sound like Tesco converts, and we had a great time there. I've been really lucky to work with businesses all over the world. Tesco's clarity of thought and process is still the strongest I've seen and found. I still perceive that it's still at the heart of their ability to adjust. You know, they adjusted in COVID really well. Their online business grew, and they were able to cope quite well with that increase. And I think that's down to the blend of their, you know, IT systems, etc. But they were able to react really well from a people and process perspective to cope with that. Yeah, clearly quite a significant change.
It's building a muscle, isn't it? I think it's a Simon Sinek quote about how you could take all the people out of an organisation and replace them with all new people, and if it's the right culture and the right, then the same things will happen. Yeah. And that seems to be the case over there through multiple changes of management, right?
Yeah, and I think it's that stability and structure and the base that, you know, means that maybe they don't have to do as much thinking on that as some of the other companies that we, you know, maybe work with and interact with. Similar to Stuart, you know, I'm the same. Lucky to have worked with a number of other businesses, but I always, yeah, without sounding too Tesco, I always kind of go back and think, you know, that was pretty awesome in terms of what we had there. And I think that's why when things change and shift, and, you know, conditions you mentioned, Stuart, around COVID or whatever, that's there, that's in the base already, and that muscle you mentioned, it's there, and then, you know, they can pivot off of that when they need to. So, and they probably don't have to invest quite as much, like I was saying, as maybe some other organisations to get that part right.
So it's given you guys a good grounding and a good sort of resilience and stuff. What are the companies that do you see in market that you really admire the way they approach things?
I mean, there's multiple. I mean, I think there's lots of different quality of product and the way Whole Foods deliver product. I've always admired, I enjoy shopping in there. Apple. There's multiple companies. I think the aspects are, how do you get a really good base in? And then I also think the other thing that people miss is, once you've got that base, it's also the continuous improvement mindset and continuing to innovate, or continuing to challenge how things are done, not just because it works. It's, what other value can be created? And I see that in some of those companies I've mentioned, where they've continued to innovate. It's that continuous improvement mindset that, again, always has the customer as the beneficiary. And that in itself creates, sort of that virtuous circle of value. But it's almost like, in different parts of the organisation, whether it be in the logistics team, the buying team, the marketing team, which ones are ready. And it's very few companies have got all of those teams all thinking in that way. Some do, but not all.
I think I just try and judge it from a consumer point of view, actually. So who are the organisations and the businesses and the brands that delight me as a customer? And I think you can then kind of go back through that, and you kind of really understand that those are the ones that are operating in the right way versus the ones that disappoint you.
I find it fascinating to work with you guys and some of the other people that we work with, and the lens in which they look at stuff. I was in a Dubai mall with a couple of fashion retail experts a few months ago, and they were sort of pointing out why certain windows worked and others didn't. And I was like, well, I just would never have noticed, but certain shops I would have gone in and actually been drawn into without realising. So I find all this stuff absolutely fascinating. What's happening in technology at the moment for these sorts of things? What are the big things that companies are talking about?
I think the thing I've experienced more since joining Tessian is it seems to be kind of end-to-end supply chain systems and processes, and that seems to be where an awful lot of the attention is focused. And back to right at the start of our conversation here, the I don't know, many millions of distribution points that you've got of product and outlet or store or location, how you're using all that data, all those data points, to manage that as efficiently as possible seems to be where an awful lot of the focus is. And there's an awful lot of technology companies, however many every week, entering the market, with a solution on a lot of this stuff. There seems to be an awful lot of, what does AI really mean? It was funny, you and I were having a conversation, Matt, where you were saying, I bet you put that into a certain retailer, Ross, that was AI, wasn't it? And I was like, was it? But yeah, I suppose it was. It's a way of using technology to automate. And
that was fascinating in itself.
But I would never have thought of it like that, actually.
That was automated forecasting and ordering, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Which was factoring in things like weather and all sorts of...
Yeah. Some just really clever people, right, who can do this stuff, And I think bringing those incredible brains and systems alongside the operators, that for me is where the real power is, when you kind of hook the teams together. I've definitely seen some organisations where there's we know best over here on the technology side, and it becomes a bit of a divide between the operational side. And I think when you bring that together, it's really powerful.
It's having that view from multiple angles, isn't it? And multiple sort of ways of thinking about the problem. Because, you guys have got a phenomenal retail background, and you think of the customer first, and, it's somebody who's perhaps, building algorithms, doesn't have that frontline knowledge and therefore needs both together, really.
Yeah, it's a blend. We've got involved with all the forecasting models, how do you deploy them in a sensible way. I think what I see a lot of, whether it be, we've done some ERP work where people are replacing their ERP, massive undertakings, and can be quite daunting and dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
The same with, I need a better forecast, or I need to automate, or automation in sort of robots and all that sort of thing. So it's really exciting because there's a whole suite of things that you could do. I think what we've helped people with is you know, who should you work with? You know, the RFI, RFP process, getting good value in that for people, because again, I find it really interesting, all the different organisations that you, across that tech landscape, that we've grown knowledge of because of working with all these different organisations. But I think how you get into that and do it in a way that is pragmatic and hits the ground and is bite-sized. You know, ERP is a really good approach in terms of, I've got to change all this, but all the data needs to be right. So there's a whole piece around how do we manage the data. Then there's, and all those connection points that you've then got to do. But I think having the business leadership knowledge to then cut through that and get to, you know, what pragmatic things are you going to do to make it land in a safe way, but then also being able to then accelerate that once you've understood it. And that applies to the forecasting systems that you've got, you know, the AI background in, and, yeah, and all the other systems that you might choose to do. So I think we've been lucky enough to see lots of different aspects of that. But I think a key difference is, how can you get that in a safe, profitable, cost-effective way to help benefit your colleagues and customers as quickly as possible? Whereas I think people can sometimes get quite lost in the enormity of what they're trying to change. Yeah, it can be a very long program, which then frustrates people and loses people's confidence.
There's no point in designing a phenomenally impressive, complex process if it's just going to sit on a shelf because it's unimplementable, right?
Yeah. So yeah, and there are organisations that have bought some really good tech product, but have then not proceeded with it, or have not got best value from it, or are struggling to find the way to get it in a way that is operationally useful.
I think it can be underestimated as well, the data. You know, I think I heard Anna talking one of these about data condition, and it's back to that rubbish in, rubbish out. And whatever the kind of processor is that's sitting in the middle of it all, it needs to be fed with the right data and the right type of condition in order for it to work properly, you know. And then secondly, how do you maintain that data in the right way, you know, through the right data governance and whatnot. Some people think it's maybe a little bit of a boring, dry subject, but it's really important.
Where do companies start with that? Because that's the number one thing that we find, right, is that you go in and there's no point in feeding an AI with data which is incomplete, mismatched, duplicated,
wrong attributes. Yeah. Exactly.
It doesn't become important until you start to try and change stuff. So, yeah, I think about putting an AI forecast system in, in just one department in a major grocer. The department got about 600 lines. So that's not too onerous. But the reality was that the data they were holding, which was not an issue yesterday because it didn't matter. They'd actually got 25,000 lines because they had never deleted any of the variants in the last 10 years because there was no need to keep maintaining the attributes that Ross talks about. So you were trying to, you know, manage 600 lines through the organisation from sourcing all the way through to the shelf edge. And you weren't able to do that because you'd actually got data that spread across 25,000 lines, which could be, you know, every size of strawberry punnet that you've ever sold, you know, in the history of that organisation. So you've got to then start cleaning that up and then working out how you're going to maintain those attributes going forward.
It's just making my head spin thinking about that. So where do you even start with something like that?
I mean, I remember not being able to get orders through because there was a decimal point in the wrong place, or you know, in a price that was nothing to do with the ordering system, but it took a feed from price that no one knew,
or a comma rather than a dot, or something.
So,
like that.
So there's all sorts of weird and wonderful things that can trip people up. But I think just having the knowledge that, in my experience, it will go wrong, and so it's almost like thinking about, well, I know it's going to go wrong, so what am I going to do to try and negate that up front? And it's having that. Again, it's working with the various teams to try and trade that off.
Yeah, because you're in danger there of never getting started, right?
Yeah.
I think 80-20, sort of get 80% right, and that's an operational mindset.
Yeah,
I've yet to find a system or an IT system where it's been launched 100%. I think you've got to go 80% and it's viable, and then work on the 20% that is then going to enhance. Yeah, and I see that time and time again, organisations not getting it right, or you see organisations, and you'll see that from a consumer point of view, where someone launches something and then it crashes and it's offline, or you can't check in at the airport or whatever it might be, and that's because I think because of some of those issues that we're describing here.
And rushing and not testing stuff.
Not testing, or not really understanding the scope or the unintended consequence. I think a lot of organisations are still trying to attempt stuff for the first time, or think they know, I've got this, you know, out of IT it'll work. Mm. And in my experience, it doesn't. And I think you need to be quite sceptical, but then have a really good way of continuing to test and learn to sort of squeeze out those issues that are going to be there. Through no one's fault. It's just that yesterday it wasn't important, and the process that people had in place wasn't thinking about the new way of working.
And creating a culture that allows people to do that is really important as well, right? Rather than there's a problem here, and we need, you know, really creating that.
Yeah, exactly. No, but a problem's great. Yeah. Problem's good. Bring the problem.
Yeah, creating a culture where you make problems visible, work them through. Mm. You know, let's move on to the next thing.
How do you go about sort of making failure, making problems acceptable? Because I know certainly from my perspective, I'd want everything that I had a hand in to succeed. But you've now got this trend of, I think Stephen Bartlett's company, he's got failure managers in his company whose job it is to find things to fail at. Mm-hmm. So how do you...
I think the teams that I've been involved with, it's just very open, and there's no blame. What needs to be true was a question we used to ask all the time. What needs to be true to make that work? I think in our careers, it's probably stood us really in really good stead to go, what does really need to be true to make that work properly? Mm. Again, it's creating an environment that's great. You've found something that would have tripped us up in 2 months' time or 3 months' time, or put us in a cul-de-sac and we would have never got out of it. So, you know, again, it goes back to that 80-20. What needs to be true, and bring it to the table and celebrate it to some degree, because that's actually people doing a really good job.
I think practical things, sorry, Matt, on that are, you know, setting up war rooms, you know, getting stuff on walls, finding ways to get into the detail of the problem and solve it, but then raise it up to communicate it to the exec, to the broader team, whoever it is, you know. It's just like practical things like that as you're working.
The physicality of that's important. It's not important. On a spreadsheet. Yeah, I mean, do it on a spreadsheet. Mm. But I still think the interaction of standing and looking at a wall or with
walking across.
And walking across and sort of visualising it, and that human interaction. And I get working from home, working remotely, all of that. But there's ways of doing that even within that environment that we've done recently that I think make a real difference. And I think the physicality of people bouncing off each other, I just think there's a way of connecting that makes a real difference.
Apply the right way of working at the right time. There's times when you need that, there's times when you don't. But
I think there's much more zoomed out about things on walls, isn't there? That rather than a spreadsheet, you're inwardly focused, I think.
Well, it's also the implications, the handoff. Yeah. It's like, we're doing that, I'm really happy with that piece. But I didn't realise it impacted, Ross's part, because people tend to look at it in isolation. Mm. And therefore, you get some really good discussion around the implications, and people have got some really good views at the table through that discussion. So facilitating that, I think, brings a different energy.
And you need, a mixture of personality types as well, because you need people who are going to drive it forward as much as people who are going to pick holes in it.
Again, pragmatic approach, You're still setting yourself and the team very strong deadlines and quite tough aspirational, like, we'd like to get this in by, and again, it goes back, well, what needs to be true and what do we need to work through? And that galvanises, I think.
Yeah, and give them the right types of people, the right conditions again, right? Some people need time to think and go away and figure it out and bring it back, need a bit more time. Some people need very different things, so... Just really trying to understand all the individuals in the team and how best to bring that together makes a big difference, I think.
I think so. I think what I've also found is that goes back to a bit of the North Star of what you're trying to achieve in the programme. So you will need to give people time to think. You will need to work some very difficult solutions. You will have a level of compromise, but I think you have to go back and that's all, that's fine. Mm. But you, I again distinctly remember in lots of different programs and things that we've delivered, you have to go back to what the North Star was. What are you trying to achieve for the customer? You were trying to improve availability. You were trying to improve quality. You were trying to improve the price or whatever it might be. So whatever your North Star was, has to be, you know, front and center and repeated from a leadership perspective, because people can end up losing sight of why they were trying to do it, and they end up sort of four fields away from where they were trying to get to. Mm. And wondering why we were over here, but actually we're now misaligned with what the business asked us to deliver.
Yeah, it's back to those principles that we talked about at the start, you know, so everybody's clear on what what they're trying to get to.
If you zoom out on all the stuff that you have worked on with that sort of, you know, improvement for customer, improvement for colleague in mind, what are you most proud of in terms of the stuff that you've worked on and delivered, and what effect, you know, what had the most effect for the customer, what had the most effect for the colleague, that is the stuff that you can pinpoint?
I think there's been various points in my career anyway. You know, I remember being really proud that we had emptied the back room completely when I was about 19 years old, and a stock controller, and just the oxygen that gave the whole operation, right through to company-wide efforts on something that was really challenging to fix.
Yeah, similar. I'm thinking about it, it's really hard to celebrate what you've probably done. Mm.
And again, we're quite on to the next thing, aren't
we? Yeah, what's next sort of thing. But I've been really lucky to be involved at different points in the careers. And I think, you know, I've been lucky enough to work in different cultures, you know, whether I worked in Asia, I've worked in Australia, I've worked in America, and obviously the UK, and each has got different cultures, each has got different ways of thinking. I suppose in a broadest sense, all the different companies that I've worked with or for and continue to do so, it is making the difference that they're able to achieve, or we collectively. And I see that even now as a consultant, being part of that team and helping them achieve, you know, a goal that they've found really difficult and that ultimately benefit the consumer that they're serving. I remember being in Malaysia and being able to change the working environment because we solved the flow of goods. Similarly in the US, working with a client out there, being able to empower you know, the store teams to make some better decisions and, again, a better environment, better visibility of stock, better availability, better customer service. Yeah, so it's all the ability to go through your career making things better with teams of people, it's good fun.
One thing that's on a lot of retailers' minds at the moment is the level of crime within retail. That seems to be a real concern for people working in shops facing shoplifting rates and violence. What processes can retailers work on to help that, to try and relieve that?
I think, I mean, it's really complex, it's really tough. I think different jurisdictions, different, depending where you operate, there's more challenging stores, more challenging environments. There's not one answer. I think there's more investment needed in certain environments, whether that be security investment, whether that be, camera tech, whether it be, you know, there's lots of things now that can monitor and inform in a better way. One of the simplest and best things that I've seen in multiple environments is that customer engagement, and that I always remember doing self-checkout rollouts in multiple countries and jurisdictions, and just that saying hello to a customer and, you know, genuinely helping them at that point, they'd be far less likely to steal or to do something untoward. I don't think you necessarily solve it. You know, it's a societal problem.
I think it's government societal. I think it's a real shame that, you know, we've gone from, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when retailers were key workers and heroes keeping us fed during a pandemic to having to live through, you know, the kind of stuff that they're going through at the moment.
Well, I think there's one part which is just protecting colleagues and what they have to go through and experience, you know, particularly at the minute, it's shocking, right? You know, I've been there myself in stores when you're having to do this type of thing, but when you feel like there's nothing coming behind it to support because of the pressures that police are under, the government, you know, all that type of stuff. That's pretty hard for the colleagues in the store, right? And then the other side of that is that if you're thinking about ultimately protecting stock, you know, from theft, then I don't think there's like a silver bullet there, right? It's so many different things. I remember doing a program once and someone asking me, you know, what are the 2 or 3 things? And you're like, it's probably more like 17, 18 things. And you've got to make sure you're looking after them all outside of the individual retailers. You know, they can lobby, but that really needs a focus. It's good to see that there is starting to be a focus. But yeah,
it's certainly... I think it's been discussed a lot more and in a lot more high profile places. I was chatting to Alistair McGeorge the other week, and he's chairman of the BRC at the moment, and they're taking it up as his number one concern. He was talking about process improvement not being transformation, and transformation to him is breaking things and then building something new off the back of it. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering what your opinions would be on that.
I think sometimes we can get hung up on the words, right? It's a bit like the AI earlier. What does it really mean? You know, transformation, what does that really mean? You know, for me, it's just about positive change, and then it's just the scale of that that is the transformation or not. So I think you can probably be fairly transformative and affect big change by sorting out processes. It all just depends where you're coming from as a base and where you're trying to get to, right? So yeah, I try not to categorise it too much, just understand the as-is and the to-be, and then the difference that's in the middle is the change.
I think similar. I think it is a scale. And I think depending on where you are in an organisation or what you're looking at will likely depend on the scale of the change. It could be anything from changing the makeup of this product within the manufacturing process to I need to change the infrastructure of my distribution depots and how they work and what level of automation I want and so on and so forth. It is still, the scale's very different maybe, but it's still process change.
Yeah.
I think I'm not sure I'd want to break something. I think where you're trying to do something new and there might be a new market or a new, you know, Alistair might be referring to that type of opportunity. You know, I can think about where, you know, organisation doesn't do wholesale. It's a retail business, but then chooses to do wholesale, then that would be transformative in terms of, and more than just process change, because you're creating a whole new approach, but you're still having to then leverage what your core business is. It's scale, and then it's the difference between process improvement at various scale within your core business versus where you're trying to drive new business or a new way of working or a new market. So I think I'd categorise it in those two spaces.
Thanks very much for joining me today to talk processes in retail.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, mate. It's been good fun.